Accession number 17572, reel 6.
Right, the story on the Buccaneer.
Yes, you were asking about the Buccaneers going off the catapult from the carrier deck, and the Mark II Buccaneer did have a problem initially when it got into service, which we took a little time to understand, in that pilots would go off the catapult and find themselves going into a stalled attitude very quickly. The aircraft would stall, fall out of the sky, and the crew would eject. Luckily, no crew were actually lost, but we did lose two aeroplanes in quick succession.
Was it too much nose up, or what?
Too much nose up.
Yeah.
We couldn't think why this should be, and then, because we were very careful at making sure that before aircraft went off a carrier deck, they were exactly in the right trim situation, but they were actually, in practice, being trimmed far too much nose up. There we found two things. First of all, that these were going off with underwing tanks, which were slipper tanks, not on a pylon. They actually fitted close to the wing surface. These were longitudinally destabilizing. So if the aircraft started rotating nose up, it would tend to continue going nose up. The other thing was that the way in which the trim was being set, we found out, it took a little time to find it out, on the decks, was quite wrong. And they were actually, because they were calibrating the tailplane wrongly, and so they were going with too much nose-up tailplane, and immediately rotating off the catapult and stalling. We developed a new technique, and it was mainly developed by, or dreamt up by, a chap who was running the Naval Test Squadron Boscombe Down, Mike Crosley. And this was to make sure the trim was right, and the pilots to leave the stick alone, literally a hands-off catapult launch. I did all the work on developing this on the catapult at Bedford, which was a ground launch catapult. So if things went wrong, you had a runway in front of you to land on. but it worked amazingly well. And the aircraft, actually, as it went down the catapult, the stick would come back a bit under the G-force, which would tend to start it rotating. And then as soon as it was off the catapult, the stick went back in the center. And it was exactly in the right trim for the launch. And it worked well from that point on, and no more aircraft were ever lost.
But when you say it was trimmed tail heavy initially, what difference did it make if the pilot didn't touch the stick? I mean, surely if he saw the nose coming up, he'd jam the stick forward and recover.
Yes, the trouble was it all happened so quickly after the catapult launch that they hadn't appreciated the nose up rotation, and it was already had reached a stalling attitude before they could recover.
And so the actual trimming was what, automatically set, or what? What adjustment did you make to the trimming, having these underwing tanks?
The recommended trim was always right. What was wrong was the calibration of the trim gauge. and I won't go into the technical details to how they calibrated them on the deck, but they got it wrong.
And that was just a few notches,
yes,
on a knob in the cockpit.
Yes.
Yes.
But all was good in the end.
Mm. Now, what trouble did you have on a Buccaneer when you had to hop up? Was it a Mark I?
Yes, that was one of the prototype Mark I's, and it was an experimental aircraft. The designers thought they could get more lift out of the wing by particularly more lift in the so-called high lift configuration, that is, with flaps down. Now, of course, a Buccaneer has got big flaps, which were blown, and ailerons, which drooped to act as flaps. So the whole trailing edge of the wing was a flap. It was all blown, so lots of lift coming out of it. But what they tried on this prototype, which was one which had finished its prototype flying, so they were just using it for experimental purposes, was increasing the size of the flaps and increasing the flap deflection to see how much more lift they could get out of the wing. I flew this aircraft, and in fact, I made one flight in it, and it was okay. The lift was obviously there, but unfortunately, because of the particularly of the extra droop on the wing on the ailerons, it was very difficult to fly. I found I was flying using lots and lots of rudder to counteract. Every time I put the stick over to one side, I get enormous amounts of side slip, and not the kind of thing you could fly in practice at all. So I reported back and said, this is what's happened. And I was asked if I would go and fly it again. And in order that they could get some measurements of how much drag they were getting from this, combined with the extra lift, they wanted to do an acceleration. And they wanted me to slow the aircraft down, start off at slow speed, as slow as I could comfortably fly, and as low as I could comfortably fly. And then go to full power and accelerate, and they'd measure the acceleration and get the drag from this. So I did this near our airfield at Holman Spalding Moor, got the aircraft settled, slow speed, went to full power, and as it started to accelerate, the aircraft was pitching nose down quite quickly. I pulled the stick back, and the aircraft pitched even more quickly nose down, instead of normally when you pull the stick back, the nose comes up, of course. I finished with the stick right in my stomach and the aircraft pitching fast nose down, and I'd started at low level, so I had the front windscreen full of field, and decided it was time to go. So I told the navigator to go, and we jumped out quite successfully.
But you have to make a pretty quick decision at that.
Close to the ground. Yes.
Yeah.
The first thing I saw when the parachute opened was the right beneath me this large burning mass which had hit the ground underneath there where I was. Luckily the wind was blowing, so we drifted off there.
And on a Buccaneer, you punch through the canopy when you go out, do you?
Eject the canopy.
You eject the canopy,
yep.
Because there are different methods, aren't there?
Yes.
I mean, you've got the explosive cord on the Hawk canopy, I believe, haven't you?
Yes.
Shatter it.
That's right.
And on other ones, you actually have a little blade on the top of the seat, don't you? So
they used to do that. They tend to go more to explosive cord on most aircraft nowadays.
Yeah. No, I saw some film that Martin Baker showed. Particularly the F-14 ejection at their base, you know, on one of the prototypes.
Yes.
And it was less than a second between getting out and the plane hitting the ground. It's quite extraordinary how quickly it all happens. Did you suffer any injury from it? Any back injury or not?
Yes, I got some of the... Certainly used to happen at the time quite almost normally, compressive crash vertebrae. Which... wasn't surprising, because since the aircraft was rotating nose down, I was actually lifted from the seat before it came up and hit me in the backside. Mm.
And what was the cause of this nose down attitude?
Oh, the cause was quite simple, actually. All this extra flap and droop had actually changed the trim of the aircraft. Now, on the Buccaneer, there was a little device on the tailplane, which was there, actually put tailplane nose up to counteract the trim of the flaps. So there was a little flap on the tailplane. That was not enough. It was enough for the normal aircraft, but with this experimental one, it wasn't enough to counteract the nose down change of trim. And when I pulled the stick back, the tailplane actually stalled, which is why it accelerated in its nose down rotation instead of stopping it. So,
at what point in your career did you go and fly American aircraft? Because you flew a number, didn't you?
Yes. Actually, I suppose it was when I was at Bedford, when, because I had as my project, amongst others, the Bristol T-188, that was the high-speed project, I was able to fly the prototype Phantom, which came across to UK when they were trying to sell the Phantom to us, which they did, of course. I managed to get a flight in that, which was a very interesting look at American aircraft, and particularly American naval aircraft. And then when I went to the States to study the, or to observe the X-15 program, which was exciting in itself, although the nearest I got to that was flying the simulator, of course, not actually flying it, I was able to fly, make several flights in the F-104 there with a pilot who became quite well known subsequently, one of the X-15 pilots called Neil Armstrong. And so we flew together on F-104s, doing chase on the X-15, practicing X-15 landings, and that was rather fun as well. You'd,
in a 104?
In a 104, which was a question of dropping everything down, and which did simulate the lift and drag, apparently, of the X-15 quite well, and making the right pattern for the X-15, and I found it actually surprisingly easy to judge, because it was almost like doing a dive bombing mission on the end of the runway. You pointed it at the end of the runway and flared when you felt about the right time to flare, and it all worked out quite nicely.
So, I mean, you just flew chase on one X-15 flight, did you?
I flew chase on one flight. I observed one flight from the control position, the big control room they had there. and I went out and watched one landing from the side of the runway. In fact, I was very lucky to have seen, to have been part of three flights, because they didn't fly that often. And it was a wonderful program.
Two of my earlier scouts were Scott Crossfield and Pete Knight.
Right.
I got quite a lot of Americans would say X-15 input, but Scott Crossfield himself is fascinating on that one, you know, and the fact that he was right in from the design.
Yes.
And the huge slab tail. You know, we were talking about the Tornado last time with its huge fin, and this was a great big tail that virtually had the same area as the wing.
Yes, indeed.
I mean, you didn't really have a chance to suss out the 104, did you? I mean, were you in the back seat or what on that? Did you actually?
I did one flight on the front seat, but I did most of the flying anyway, whether back seat or front seat. Mm. And I flew front seat rides subsequently when I was in Germany with the Tornado in German F-104s.
What's your experience of the 104? I mean, was it a cow to fly or what? Was it very dangerous? And why did the Germans lose so many?
I'll answer the first question first. It was not a cow to fly. It did have some problems, but it was an early jet aircraft with a remarkable performance. A small wing, but basically it was a nice aircraft to fly, and great fun as well. The Germans, funnily enough, they did not actually have that many problems. I'll rephrase that. They had a lot of problems with the aircraft, but the reason they had a lot of problems, they had so many of them. And you analyse the numbers of accidents they had with their 104s in comparison with all the other European air forces, for instance, who had 104s, the numbers of accidents against the numbers of aircraft they had were almost exactly the same. But because the Belgians and the Dutch and the other air forces didn't have so many of them, it never hit the headlines, but it really did in Germany.
But wasn't it used at low level when it wasn't designed for that? Or, I mean, didn't the Germans have it as a low-level strike aircraft?
They did use it as a strike aircraft. I don't know, they lost aircraft because, I mean, one of the reasons they lose aircraft is because it was a single engine aircraft with a relatively early jet engine, and you lose the engine, you're almost certainly going to lose the aircraft as well. They did have some maintenance problems, which they overcame, but that was partly because they were not actually training their ground crew terribly well at one time. But they, being Germans, they overcame that when they realised they were doing it.
I remember seeing a 104 close to and touching the leading edge and almost cutting my finger on it.
Yes.
I mean, it was, was it very tricky at low speeds, or didn't you land at low speeds?
Well, it came in quite hot.
Yeah.
Sure. Yes, it wasn't an aircraft that you messed around with very much at very low speeds, but you made sure you didn't get in that situation.
And it was a true Mach 2 fighter, was it?
Yes.
Yeah. What about the Phantom? I mean, that was a highly successful aeroplane. I mean, did it exude its success to you when you flew it? Was it a right aeroplane, like a Mosquito?
Yes, very much so.
Yeah.
A tremendous performance. I mean, all the speed and height records it got when in early days were all quite genuine, of course. Quite a big, heavy aeroplane. But it overcame that by sheer performance and nice aircraft to fly.
Because the fact that it was designed as a naval fighter to begin with, so its performance had to be skewed down to accommodate a deck landing, meant that when the Air Force got it, I suppose they had, you know, comparative short field performance out of it as well.
Yes. Mm. Yes, well, certainly compared with a lot of the other, their sharp F-100 series.
Which
were very hot machines.
Mm. Now, this was before you went on to the Jaguar program, presumably, while you were still at...
Yes, Oxford. Yes,
yeah.
It was.
I don't know, you talked a lot about the Jaguar last time. I don't know if you've thought about anything you haven't mentioned. We talked about the horrifying spinning characteristics and your low-level flight over the Andes, different ways of working between the British and the French. Is there anything that's occurred to you to add? Last spoke.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I could talk about Jaguar for hours. I don't think anything that's really that I need to emphasise on the Jaguar.
Among that talking for hours, there are no sort of salient historical points that you feel you could highlight.
I think we said before that it was an aircraft which had a very bad reputation, but finally seemed to come good when people realised it wasn't that bad at all. It was knocked very hard by the French. And it was a fascinating situation because we spent a long time persuading the Indian Air Force to buy Jaguar. The same time the French were trying to sell the Mirage to the Indian Air Force, and the French salesman was saying, don't buy Jaguar, we know it's no good, we make it, we make half of it.
Yeah.
But the Indian Air Force did buy Jaguar, of course, and they were quite pleased with their Jaguars too.
They manufactured it in India, didn't they, in the end?
Yes, they did. They manufactured it, and they also put their own Navitax system in. And I had one interesting situation when I arrived at Bangalore one day just to go and see how they were getting on before they were still setting up the production line. And I was invited into an office, and there, sitting on the opposite side of the table they put me at, were six Indian Air Force and civilians, all with notebooks, and they said, right, just a minute, we want to know how to develop a nav attack system. And that being thrown at you out of the blue is quite disconcerting.
When you say they devised it, I mean, did they manufacture it as well? Did they have their own electronic industry to do it for them?
No, they actually bought one which was not quite off the shelf. It was mainly French, partly Indian, that they put in the aircraft because it was going to be a lot cheaper. But they don't save money in the end by trying to develop a completely new system.
Mm-hmm. about the tornado, any other thoughts on that? Again, you could probably talk for hours on it.
Oh yes, I could. Well,
we again cover the German attitude and the story of the Big Finn and the fact that you push things ahead by accident.
Yes. I think one interesting aspect of tornado development was we did get going. We did achieve an awful lot in terms of the amount of work we can do on each individual flight, and we did this by persuading the Royal Air Force to start flight refueling the aircraft very early, because we started off with inevitably it was a new engine with engines which were way down on power, so we're now 30% down on the powers they were going to develop. And so we didn't have much performance when we were doing the high-speed flutter testing, for instance. So we got the flight refueling sorted out very early in the program, and we would the RAF were immensely cooperative. They would always manage to have a tanker in the area when we happened to be flying Tornado. On an exercise, of course, and we go and do a high speed run, pull up to altitude, plug into the tanker, leave, and then do another high speed run, perhaps a high altitude high speed run, and sometimes even go back again and refuel twice, because particularly with those low thrust engines, getting performance at the aircraft was quite difficult, and you'd use all the fuel just arriving at the whatever particular Mach number you were heading for.
I mean, when you did your high speed runs, was it, did you have to use afterburner all the time? Or?
Yes. Oh yes. Not many aircraft like Concorde, which you can cruise without using afterburner.
Really. Mm. So, I mean, did the RB199s come up to full power eventually?
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Oh yes, and of course they're to higher power than the early versions were expected to get to as they develop the, I mean, the engine which goes into the F3 now is a much higher power version than the ones which I was flying.
But what is the percentage of fuel consumption increase when you light the afterburners? Is it about as much again? Does it double your fuel?
Oh, easily, yeah. Easily, particularly at low level. Mm.
So yes, you use them just to squirt yourself into a certain position, I suppose, and
yes,
out of a certain position. Yeah. And the Tornadoes, presumably, when you talked about flight refueling, I mean, they were all designed and built with the probes already fitted.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. Now, when you went out to Saudi Arabia for sort of support for the, what was it, the lightning program, wasn't it?
Yes.
Was that after you'd stopped flying?
Yes and no.
When was that? Which year would that be?
Well, when I first went to Wharton, we were working on the Saudi Arabian lightnings, and so I delivered several lightnings out to Saudi Arabia. Then a couple of years later, when I became chief test pilot, I used to go out to Saudi Arabia to see how they were getting on, and I made roughly one trip a year just to see how the Saudi Air Force were getting on with the aircraft. I never actually expected to go there permanently, but when I came to retire from flying, quite out of the blue, I was invited by a managing director to go and run the program out there, which seemed like an interesting challenge compared with flying, even. And so, hence, I took my way out to Riyadh. This was I finished flying December 82, so beginning of January 83, went out to Saudi Arabia to look after the British aerospace interests out there. And at that time, we had lightnings, and the lightning program was running down. The Saudis were looking at other aircraft to replace them with. We also had the Strike Master, development of the Jet Provost trainer, which we were using for training the Saudi Air Force, and we provided the instructor pilots as well. The Saudis were going to buy either the Tornado or the Mirage. Saudi Air Force actually decided they would go for the Mirage, but for various political reasons, it was decided that Tornado would be the aircraft they would have.
And this is a GR1, was it, or both types?
Both.
Both.
And it was nice to be out there, having developed a Tornado for the RAF, and see the Tornado into service with a brand new Air Force, and an overseas Air Force.
How did you find your time out there? Stimulating? Frustrating?
Yes, both of those. everything. The Saudi is not the easiest of nations to work with, but it was very exciting to... we got an enormous contract, which not only involved selling airplanes, the Tornadoes, Hawks, and the PC-9 trainer, we sold them naval ships, which came through Vosper Thornycroft, radars, almost anything in the defence field. We even had a big construction program going out there, so there were lots of new challenges for me to get my teeth into.
And who did you work to out there? The Minister of Defence or the Chief of the Air Staff, equivalent of, or who was your main government liaison man? You had to keep happy.
The Chief of the Air Force was the chap that I worked with directly. Yes, very much so.
And what were the sort of problems you had to face out there? I mean, were there cultural differences in this area of high technology that you had to bridge? Or?
Not really. And there were cultural differences in that we had a large workforce of our own out there, of course, and probably had more difficulties with our own British workforce than with the Saudis. But that was a separate concern.
That was mainly over booze, was it, or what?
Booze was a large part of the problem, yes. Yeah. In fact, there was even, as I found when I first arrived there, a smuggling racket going on. But put a stop to that. The culture difference in terms of training the Saudi Air Force... and we trained both pilots and all the ground crews. We ran the technical training school, and we trained the ground crews on operating the on how to service the aircraft. The average Saudi is not terribly keen to learn. They're quite happy to be told how to do something once, but then after they've been told once, then they don't want to know about it again. And so to make sure that they keep in practice and keep on practicing was a bit of a headache for our chaps. They also tend to take a lot of time off. If they have a family problem, they'll disappear and come back weeks or months later. And re-motivating them was quite difficult at times. So, yes, there were some cultural differences, but we got used to those. And the pilots were the same. They were mostly very competent, but they never liked practicing things too much.
You were coming to a country where there was no state of national air-mindedness, was there? I mean, in this country, you've got kids growing up, going to Farnborough, going to air displays, joining the ATC, being imbued with aviation culture before they even get near an aeroplane. Whereas presumably in Saudi Arabia this didn't happen. You had to start really from basics, didn't you, if you were training?
Yes, we did.
Yeah.
Yes, we did. But interestingly, I mean, one of my very good friends in the the Saudi Air Force grew up in the desert, and he had no modern technology at all in his early days, in his youth, and yet he coped extremely well with flying modern airplanes. So it can be done.